enemy.
What are you trying to say? The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens is a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times. They never get it because the real solution always eludes them.
What is it?
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, where it is quite cool today, quite cool, and the wind is cold too. Yeah. Okay, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your goodies, your donations for the radio show. And then I work hard to send you out a show every day but Saturday and Sunday. And that's when I do all my honey-do stuff. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Anyhow, that wind chill is really cold today. Yeah.
And you close the door behind you. Will you walk in your sleep, or will you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And he's gone down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera, saw it all.
Bit of information I picked up in the wee hours of the morning on the BBC. I never realized this. They had found quite a long time ago a footprint, the oldest footprint in the Northlands in England. Human footprint 800,000 years old. So when you say, where's Whitey been? Well, he's been around for a long time. How about that? 800,000 years old. I'll bet you didn't know that they used to down south have electric chairs, execution chairs that they they were portable and used to take them from town to town. Many times those electric chairs were used for Negroes. I'm going to play you a little clip about a guy by the name of McGee. He was a Negro that decided to, it was okay for him to cross over the colored line and sleep or assault a white woman. Here's the story.
One, close to 1,000 people gathered around the courthouse in the small town of Laurel, Mississippi. They came to witness the execution of Willie McGee, a young black man convicted of raping a white woman. The local radio station was there, broadcasting the event live. McGee's case had wound through 3 trials in 6 years, garnered support from William Faulkner, Paul Robeson, Albert Einstein, and others, and appeared in newspapers around the world. But after the execution, the story of Willie McGee was largely forgotten. Some 60 years later, McGee's granddaughter, Bridget, teamed up with Radio Diaries to search for the true story of Willie McGee and the traveling electric chair.
This is a case that has gone through 6 years of law courts. Certainly it's a scene that nobody likes to see, the execution of any human being. But when it becomes necessary, it must be done. Here earlier this evening, we got a glimpse of the electric chair. Indeed, it was a frightening thing, to be sure.
Growing up, I didn't know anything about the story. Nothing. It was never talked about in our house. My name is Bridget McGee Robinson. I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I am the granddaughter of Willie McGee.
On the grounds of the Laurel Courthouse, they wait for the news that Willie McGee has been executed for his crime.
I remember I was about 12 or 13 years old. I was with my mom. We were cleaning out her room. She was under her mattress, and there was these newspaper articles inside a plastic bag. And there was a photograph. And so I said, who's this man? And she said, that's your grandfather. And I asked her, well, what happened to him? But she snatched it from me and told me to put it back. She says, you wouldn't understand that right now. So I let it go for years. And basically on my mother's deathbed is when she began to talk to me about it. And she told me to find out the truth. I told her, okay. Welcome to Mississippi. I haven't been in Mississippi since I was a little girl, but here I am. I came here to find out what happened to my grandfather. I want to know the good, and I also want to know the bad. I want to hear it from the blacks. I want to hear it from the whites. I don't know where my journey will lead, but I know where it has to start.
We're walking up the steps of the Jones County Courthouse.
This is the courthouse.
Yes, in recent
I met up with a man named Harvey Warren who grew up in Laurel, Mississippi.
This is the location where the electric chair was brought and Willie McGee was executed.
Do you know of anyone that may talk about it? Or
even today, most people do not want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to put in your grasp of what took place is the climate. Everything was segregated. That was our side of the tracks, which was mostly across the GMNO, and then that was the white folks side of the tracks, which is west of the Southern Railroad. And lives were lived that way. And I knew, even as a six-year-old, where I could go and where I could not go. And Willie McGee, obviously, we knew that he had gone on the wrong side of the tracks.
Laurel Leader called November 5th, 1945. Willie McGee, 30-year-old Laurel Negro, was arrested in connection with the assault of a white woman, which occurred at her residence early Friday morning.
My name is Ann Sanders. I'm a native of Laurel, Mississippi, and I covered the first Willie McGee trial for the Laurel Leader Call newspaper. It was just unheard of, a black man raping a white woman. I mean, the fact that he came into a white woman's house and raped her, it just incensed everybody. It really did. The rumor got out that they were going to get him out of jail and were going to lynch him. So when he came for the trial, they brought him in a National Guard truck for his protection.
My name's John Schwarzfeger. My father was the district attorney and a prosecutor of Willie McGee. the truth of the matter is that Willie McGee was going to be convicted. You had 12 white males on the jury who have to make a decision. Are we going to believe the white lady, or are we going to believe the black man?
When Mrs. Hawkins testified, she said that she had a baby about 3 months old, and her husband had gone up into the living room to go to sleep, and Willie McGee had come in, got into the bed, and put a knife to the baby's throat and said, "If you don't, you know, agree, I will kill your baby." So she, of course, couldn't do anything else. And Willie McGee, he did not defend himself during that whole trial. I never heard him utter a single word. Of course, he was scared to death. And I noticed the chair was wet. Pants were wet, and there was a puddle under the chair. He had to wet himself. The decision was real quick. The jury stayed out only a few minutes. The judge told him, "Willie McGee, your sentence is to be electrocuted."
Hello.
Can you hear me, Ingo?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm calling you, and I got you on the recorder because I'm taping this information. Okay, Ingo, say your name and who you are. Go ahead.
My name is Della Marie McGee Johnson.
And you are?
Willie McGee's oldest daughter.
So, Aunt Della, when you first heard about what happened to Granddaddy, you, Mama, Aunt Gracie, Uncle Lero, you know, when they first came to you guys and said he'd been arrested, do you remember that?
The reason why
my Aunt Della, she's the only child of Willie McGee left. And she said, "My mama told me the whole story of what happened with the alleged victim and my grandfather.
I was told that they had been going together. And then when they finally got caught, they accused them of rape."
Did they say how long they had been dating or going together?
No, I don't know if it was years or what. But back in the South, you know, black men can fool with no white women. But the white men can fool with the black women. So,
well, you know, I'm researching all this information. You think I'm opening up a can of worms?
Maybe.
All right, I love you.
All right, love you too.
All right, bye-bye.
There he is, the white view and the black view of what took place with Willie McGee. Blacks, for the most part, we understood that Willie did not rape that woman. He was in a relationship with this woman. And with Willie McGee being self-confident, you know, and good-looking, pretty sure about himself, he was too bold to just, once they got a whiff of it, to leave town. Just run away, go to Detroit someplace. He was going to remain here, you know, and that was the result.
I'm interviewing all these people and reading letters, newspaper articles, the court documents, but I'm still missing some things. I would love to speak with Willette Hawkins, the alleged victim, but she died a long time ago, and her family does not want to talk about this. They don't want to bring this up anymore.
Come in. Okay. Come on in, sit down.
I'm here at the home of Raymond Horn, who was a young reporter for the Laura Leader Call at the time of the execution.
I just kind of wonder, you know, after, what, 60 years almost, why this is so revived.
I'm doing it because I want some history. Mm-hmm. I'm like the family historian.
I can be very sympathetic with you because I'm a historian by family, and I believe in that kind of business. But I've discovered, especially in family histories, that usually there are some wonderful things that you find and some very bad things that you find. Now, one of his defenses was that it was consensual. Did you hear that?
Right.
That it was consensual. That is one of the craziest arguments that can be made.
But hearing that it was consensual, it wouldn't be no different than a black woman sneaking around going with a white man. It happened all the time.
Personally, in my lifetime, I was never aware of a white woman that had a consensual relationship with a black man. I'd never heard of it. I don't find it plausible at all. But there's no way to say this was the way it was, because the parties that knew are deceased. There's no way to know. Period.
Laurel Leader Call, December 27, 1945. The case of Willie McGee, Negro, convicted of raping a white woman, will be appealed to the state Supreme Court. The fight to save the life of Willie McGee has been taken over by the newly formed Civil Rights Congress.
A case like that sometimes becomes a symbol. My name is Liz Abzug. My mother was Bella Abzug, former congresswoman from New York, and she was one of the defense lawyers in the Willie McGee case. You know, coming into a small town in rural Mississippi, you know, these communist lefties, northern Jews, people were kind of in disbelief. You know, it was like, why is she here?
What's her name? Bella Abzug. She come down here to make sure he had a good trial, and sometimes she was just a downright nuisance. I mean, you tell her something and she, why do you know that? Well, why do you know that? She just thought he was being railroaded, and she took it all the way to the Supreme Court to stay the execution.
New York Times, April 1st, 1951. Several thousand demonstrators paraded in Times Square against the execution of Willie McGee. Several large groups chanted, "Jim Crow, must go, free Willie McGee."
One white man and one white woman in a little old town, back then probably 20,000 people. I don't know why this one struck a fire, but it hit the loop.
Some very well-known figures became involved. William Faulkner, Albert Einstein. There were even leaflets dropped over soldiers who were fighting the Korean War to let them know about Willie McGee.
It became more of a cause, and I think Mr. McGee got lost in the magnitude of all of it.
His case covered 5 years and 5 months and involved 3 trials, 6 stays, and 3 state Supreme Court refusals. And that was it. That was it.
The Mississippi Correctional Officers Academy.
Hi. Yes, we wanted to come in and see the traveling electric chair.
Yes, ma'am. But it's been here a long time. We've had it a long time.
Long time.
But it's over in that front lot.
Okay, thank you.
Mississippi used to have what they called a traveling electric chair. They would take it from town to town. They would set it up in the courthouse, electrocute the person, pack it up, and take it to the next spot. Then we come around the corner, and there is this electric chair, not on display, just sitting in a corner with some baseball trophies. It was not what I expected at all.
Is this sure this is the right one?
I thought the electric chair would look like, I don't know, something made of metal with a head thing that comes off on your head or something, or it's just a wooden rocking chair is what it looks like. Chair that somebody would sit on their porch and watch the cars go by. Who in their right mind created this thing? I don't know, this is just it. I don't want to record anymore.
I'm sure that you have heard over both radio stations, WFOR and WAML, that all channels open to Willie McGee to save his life have now been exhausted, and the execution is to take place here this evening.
I went up that night to watch the execution, and the crowd was already gathering. There were hundreds of people all over the place.
The weather was good. It was a nice night because it wasn't too hot and it wasn't too cold. People were visiting with each other and, you know, talking and passing time away.
I think the majority of the crowd is now over here on this side of the courthouse where they can see and hear the power unit for the state of Mississippi's portable electric chair.
The execution was broadcast on the radio. And I'll never forget to this day, as the announcer mentioned some young boy who had climbed up a tree.
We note that there's a boy over here in a tree climbing ever higher into the branches.
And was looking inside
like
the window.
See it. He's up there in that tree looking
where
into the window.
Mr. McGee was going to be executed.
It's now straight up of 12 o'clock, and certainly there can be no more than 2 minutes left to go.
And I think perhaps the best thing we could do is just hang this mic over and pick up the grind of that generator so that we'll be sure and pick it up. Jim, if you're listening, you might jack our gain up a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, we just assumed that that last surge was the final few thousand volts of electricity that met the end of Willie McGee. Okay, Granville, thank you very much. Certainly WAML and WFOR intended no sensationalism in this. It was simply that it was a news story, and we wanted to cover it as best we possibly could. So thank you all very much for listening. This is Jack Dix then returning you to your respective local studios.
Willie McGee's body was taken to Pete Christian's funeral home, and my mother and father took me over there. And I knew what I was going there for, you know. It was like a business that had to be taken care of. And you go in there and you view the body, and I did not close my eyes. I did not close my eyes because that was a specific message that my daddy wanted me to get. And that message was, you do not get connected with white girls. You see what happened to Willie McGee. And I understood that. And, you know, my daddy let me see it long enough to get the message and then took me back home.
After his execution, everybody pretty well washed their hands. That was the end of it. They said, we've suffered. The city has suffered. We're glad it's over. Let's forget it.
The blacks and whites didn't talk about it between them. Even today, none of the blacks I've had that helped me through the years, we never mentioned it. They believed he was innocent, and the whites believed he was guilty. Simple as that. It's always going to be that way. And it was just not a good thing to argue about it.
There's one more person I really need to speak with. I am going now to meet John Schwarzfeger. His dad prosecuted my grandfather back in 1951. He was the one who basically sent my grandfather to the electric chair. So we came up to his house, and I was very nervous. And he opened up the door, and him and his wife, and they looked at me, and he hugged me.
Well, I remember the night of the execution very well. We were all standing in the kitchen, and my father reached up in the cabinet and got a pint of bourbon, and he took the fifth of whiskey, hid it inside his coat, and when he got to the courthouse, he told the sheriff that he wanted to see Willie McGee alone in a room, just the two of them. And they sat and they talked while Mr. McGee drank the whiskey. And my father asked him, said, did you or did you not rape Mrs. Hawkins? Were you guilty? And he got his answer. And my father never divulged it to anyone else, and I'm not going to divulge it now.
I wouldn't want you to go against your father's wishes. But I still want to know as much history as I can about my grandfather. I'm not looking for him to be wrong, nor I'm trying to find out if he was right. But it sure would make me feel better to know.
I certainly appreciate what you're saying. But we have to take into consideration there was a pint of bourbon involved. And this man was facing death in a matter of an hour or so. And what a person would say at that time, especially if they'd been drinking, I just don't think it's fair to repeat them.
But I also know that a drunk speaks a sober mind. And at that point in time, what did he have to lose anyway?
I wish I wouldn't have told you. Now, I really do. Because as much as I know that everybody wants me to say, he said, yes, he did it, or no, he didn't do it, is I can't say that. I'm not going to say that. To keep rehashing something that happened 60 years ago can't possibly bring about any good now.
But me as a granddaughter, I'm here to get information because there's another generation ahead of me that carries the McGee name now. And they don't even know any of the history of what happened. So that's my place.
Bridget, I certainly have a great deal of compassion for your family. I mean, none of y'all did anything. I'll give you your answer because I think you're entitled to it. But I'm going to do it to you, off the record, alone. Is that fair enough?
That's fair.
All right.
How you doing?
I'm good.
I'm Bobby.
We're trying to locate where my grandfather could be buried, where his body could be laid.
If they were buried during that time frame, they would be in this location right out here somewhere. You know, but there are a lot of grave sites out there. The markers have been knocked off, and all there is just like a little indentation in the ground to show that there's a body that's buried there.
We might have liked to see. So you're saying anything that's unmarked could be Willie McGee's gravesite?
Yes.
For all I know, I could be standing on top of his grave. Who knows? Things are never as clear-cut as we want them to be. The words that my grandfather said that night before his execution, I've been keeping those words a secret. But recently, John Schwarzfeger has given me permission to share them. The prosecutor asked my grandfather as they were drinking, "Did you have sex with Willette Hawkins?" And my grandfather looked up at him and said, "Yes, sir. But she wanted it just as much as I did." How do I feel about those words? I don't know. I'm not really sure. I don't think we will ever know the total truth. But I know what I believe, and that's my truth. And so when my kids and my grandkids, my nephews and my great-nephews come to me and ask me who was my great-grandfather, I'll be able to tell them. This is the story of Willie McGee.
I thought that was a very good piece of history, good information there about the life and times of segregation. Now, you can see there, like in Laurel, Mississippi, they had complete separation, but the problem with segregation was that you live separately, different sides of the tracks and the whole bit, but during the day, most of these black people that were working for a white overseers or white businessmen or white whatever. And that's where the rub comes in, and that's why segregation does not work. You have to have complete, absolute separation. Now also, remember too, that they had it down so pat that a black man would not dare cross those tracks on pain of death like Willie McGee and involve himself with a white woman, because it was going to be either lynching or the electric chair, the traveling electric chair, which I had never heard of. And so most of the blacks knew absolutely for sure, like the young boy who was taken into the funeral parlor, you don't screw with the white women. Now, I agree that there probably was a certain amount of white women that lusted after black men and things like that, and the people, women like that should be put in the electric chair right beside the black man, as far as I'm concerned. But I thought you would find this an interesting piece of history that I was luckily able to pick up off the radio. And nature's law was not whether it was consensual or not, it was a death penalty to do it, period. Well, I see that some of the boys around the country and some from overseas finally dug out my Race and Reason television show of my session with Wally George. And I believe that is up on YouTube. I don't think we have all stuff up on YouTube because they banned me from YouTube. But I would like to get them all up there, and if you want to help with that, well, that would be fine, because there's some great shows up there. We did a lot of shows, but that Wally George show was one of the best, and it was part tongue-in-cheek and a lot of reality. It was back when everybody was going homicidal over the Soviet Union, and I was saying, we don't want to have war with the Soviet Union. We don't want to have nuclear war. And also, I defined the Soviet Union as state capitalism, not communism. It was not communism. The people who ran the communist, so-called Communist Party, these people were actually like the top capitalists are today. There was a small group of them that technically owned everything and controlled everything and had lived their vacations and everything else at Dhaka's homes down by the Black Sea and all that kind of stuff. So, of course, it was a myth, and that they were actually communist. If they had been, well, communism won't work. It's just all, it's impossible. You can have tribalism, and you could have short-term communism among a tribe, but as soon as some of the people started figuring out the other people were not carrying their load and working to feed everybody else, they would have been driven out of the tribe. So communism itself is an impossibility, just as much an impossibility over the long haul as democracy, which is a sham also. But that show was made back when Ronald Reagan was president, and I was damning him every which way and telling what a rat he was when everybody in the KKK was voting for him and supporting him. And I went after him way back then, which was not a popular thing to do. You know, it's quite interesting that both Armin Hammer, Jew, who was in bed with the Communist Party and Soviet government for a long time, and that's where he started building his fortune, that he was also a very staunch conservative, funneling tremendous amounts of money into the Republican Party and supporting people like Ronald Reagan, which goes along with those, what are they, Cohen brothers, or I forget the name, that are the billionaire promoters of the Republican Party today and the Tea Party. And they started building their fortune working with Stalin and the Soviet Union too. I wonder why that aspect of history is not brought out very much, because these conservatives are always, these conservatives, neocons, are always bragging about their wonderful Ronald Reagan and people like that, and trying to deny that these top Jew billionaires were in bed with the Soviet Union and Stalin. I see another crazy thing coming out of Chicago. Cook County moving forward with an ammo tax proposal. How about that? Yeah. Lordy, lordy, you mean I can buy ammunition freely in Chicago where guns are banned? Talk about hypocrisy. Ah, Chicago. Chicago, that wonderful town. The town that religious fanatic Billy Sunday couldn't shut down. I see the University of Minnesota wants to stop a commemoration of 9/11 because it's racist. Quote, this resolution was non-controversial and was supported by MSA's president and vice president, said Amundsen. However, several members in exchange with CR's rep Theo Menon were militant in their opposition to it due to the perceived bias towards Muslims. Other proponents of the resolution argued in forum that its passage would bring up controversial topics. I guess controversial topics are automatically racist. And that a healthy dialogue and campus tension reduction, well, I guess you'll have to kick all the whites off the campus, would ensue from the moment of recognition. That large MSA representative and director of diversity and inclusion, David Algotti, and I'll bet he's not black, voiced severe criticism of the resolution. He also made sure to emphasize 9/11 status as a national tragedy in his response. Quote, "The passing of this resolution might make a space that is unsafe for students on the campus even more unsafe," unquote. Islamophobia and racism fueled, though, they are alive and well. Algotti added that the holding a moment of recognition over a tragedy committed by non-white perpetrators could increase racist attitudes on the campus, asking, "When will we start having moments of silence for all of the times white folks have done something terrible?" Oh, there you go. Universities, maybe it's a good idea that they're charging its students so much. Maybe we're better off if that's the way the universities are going to be run. The hell with it. Make it so expensive, nobody can go. Well, how do you like this one? Jerusalem. Security camera footage of a deadly Israeli arrest raid in a West Bank hospital on Thursday gave a rare glimpse into the murky undercover units that Israel contends are a key tool in preventing violence, and Palestinians reviled as ruthless symbol of Israeli occupation. In the footage, Israeli officers disguised as Palestinian civilians in Arab garb, including some wearing fake mustaches and beards, or dressed as women, burst into the hospital and dragged away a wanted Palestinian in a wheelchair. Yeah, the Mossad is hard at work. They keep talking about the German outfits in World War II doing such bad things. If they did, they're copying him. Well, it's Freya's Day for the she-wolves, and we send out our respect to the she-wolves. But it's almost the weekend, so let's tune in to Max Kaiser and see if we're going to have any money on Monday morning.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Cicero
once said, "The life of the dead is placed in the memory of the living." If he were alive today, he might say, "The memory of the living is placed in the life of the dead." So many small memories of what life our economies once had in the dead industries, the zombie banks, the broken markets, which stalk us today.
Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, Stacy.
That's so profound. Well, you know, our first headline is about the dead global trade. And this is it's official. The Baltic Dry Index has crashed to its lowest November level in history. And I have a chart, and that is the plunging. This is 2015. And this blue line is the 30-year average for the Baltic Dry Index. And the Baltic Dry Index measures the cost of shipping goods around the world, dry goods around the world. And, of course, there has been an oversupply in the production of building these container ships. But also there's been a collapse in exports from China, for example.
Right. Well, one way that the economy is punked into looking better than it is by counting the stuff being manufactured as it leaves the factory and not counting if it's actually sold. So you end up with vast parking lots full of unsold cars that were clocked as part of the growing car business when it left the factory, but nobody actually is buying the cars, as we see by this index of containers that would be transporting things like cars, you see?
Yeah.
Since the price is collapsing because there's no demand,
yeah.
Because actually the demand side of the equation. Now, speaking about demand, the whole point of quantitative easing, the whole point of Keynesianism, the whole point of deficit spending is to stimulate aggregate demand. That's a phrase, you look it up. Oh, aggregate demand. We're going to stimulate aggregate demand. Well, aggregate demand is not being stimulated. So either take more drugs, different drugs, or stop taking drugs because it's not working.
We actually have a headline about that in the future, but I want to move on to the next headline about our broken markets and how they have contributed to the death, the decline, and the decay we see all around us.
Tell the people!
There's a new way traders are defrauding the market, and they're starting to get busted for it. So Panther Energy trader Michael Cassia has been found guilty in a high-profile market manipulation trial in Chicago. His crime? Spoofing. And this is something you and I have been talking about for years here on the show, but now it's finally entered the domain of the Department of Justice, who took on Panther Energy trader in Chicago. What is spoofing? A trader makes a large bet on or against the security. The market reacts to that bet, sending the security's price up or down. The trader cancels their bet once the market reacts. The trader takes advantage of other investors' reactions by betting on or against the security for real. So here you have basically rigging markets. But the interesting thing is that no one's going to make $1 million on a specific trade, said Peter Henning, a securities litigation professor at Wayne State University. You're going to make a dollar on a million trades. And of course, you're not going to make that same dollar from each person. So this is part of the way they've been getting away with it. And we've talked about this all the time. In this trade, they're stealing a dollar from every market participant. Some trades are stealing a fraction of a penny from each market participant.
Well, one thing is it's not new.
No.
Spoofing has been going on for quite some time, as has high-frequency trading, which is also coming under the scrutiny by various regulators. That suggests to me that these particular ways of manipulating markets, which are now more than 15 years old, if not 20 years old, will probably fade, and we'll start to see the actual new ways that bankers and traders will start to defraud markets using new technologies, and we'll report on that on this show, and then it won't become new and looked at for another 10 years. So this is not new. This is what we've been saying for years now. And the funny thing about spoofing is that it actually, you're enticing other manipulators in the market who are looking to front run. So front running is actually on an industrial scale, like high frequency traders. This is also illegal and undermines the integrity of price discovery and markets. So you have one group, the high frequency traders, that are waiting to defraud the markets by looking at large orders in the market, and the spoofers are placing fake large orders in the markets. So you have two camps of defrauders eyeing each other, and in the middle, you don't have actual price discovery. You have the result of massive fraud perpetrated against another group perpetuating massive fraud, and as a result, there's no true price discovery. So the price of stuff actually is not reflected by supply and demand, and this is why, even though they quantitatively ease into existence trillions of dollars worth of more government bonds, the price keeps going up, and even though the demand for gold around the world is even higher, the price goes down. So all the rules of supply and demand in the economy have turned upside down because it's fraudsters trying to make bets against other fraudsters.
Yeah, and not only that, but everybody knows there's so much fraud in there, so regular normal people and also regular, you know, sort of predatory bankers don't go in the market because they know it's just going to be taken by an algorithm that is so fast that you can't possibly even think fast enough about how it's going to happen, and it does. They just take it. So why would anybody go in the markets? That's the death of that market, just like the death of global trade is partly caused by what you said, quantitative easing. All the money keeps on going more and more to the top, and then the top realizes that they have more and more of the money, meaning those people at the bottom don't have any money, so we're going to hoard this money because why would we use it to, you know, to build things or make things, because we know the bottom doesn't have any money because we have it all. So nobody wants to build anything because they know they have all the money and those people don't have enough money to buy whatever they could possibly make.
Right. The people who are stealing money in this way are creating monopolies. And so we have a return of the robber barons that at the turn of the 20th century were dismantled with the help of politicians like Teddy Roosevelt. But now here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and all the tendency toward oligopolization, monopolization, duopolies are being reintroduced, Warren Buffett being a classic example of a monopolist, a robber baron, who's simply using free money and fraud to pick up huge controlling stakes in consumer companies like Heinz Ketchup or Coca-Cola, things that people spend a few bucks on every single day. Well, a lot of that money goes right into Warren's pocket.
Sure, and we've had the consolidation of big banks around the world. in 2007. We had too big to fail. We have now too bigger to fail. We have consolidation there. We have also consolidation in the health insurance industry in America. There's bigger and bigger mega corporations from which you have to buy your insurance. There might be only one or two or three in any single market. We also have that in pharmaceutical companies that you've seen these all these massive pharmaceutical companies merge and become even bigger. Well, there's one here which is a remarkable story. Speaking of death, it is now, you know, the spike in death in white American males between the ages of 25 and 54 is unprecedented in history. The last time we saw something like that was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But what's happening in America, what the number one cause of this is suicide, but most importantly, it's heroin overdose and opiate overdose, opiate death overdose. So here is a headline regarding this Department of Justice. Well, various attorneys general from states are going after this company, the Painkiller, a drug company putting profits above patients. The United States' opiate drug problem isn't limited to illegal narcotics. The sale of dangerously addictive painkillers prescribed by physicians has quadrupled in the past decade, and one company in particular is pushing pain to the legal edge of aggressive radical marketing. This company is called Insys, and their Scottsdale, Arizona-based Insys Therapeutics revenue is almost entirely derived from the highly addictive opiate fentanyl, which it markets under the brand name Subsys Fentanyl. Fentanyl products are, quote, the most potent and dangerous opioids on the market, said Dr. Andrew Kolodny. According to some physicians, fentanyl is about 100 times more powerful than morphine and gets into the bloodstream faster because it is sprayed under the tongue. So we're seeing this massive increase in deaths due to opiate overdose. In fact, you're twice as likely to die from an opiate overdose in America than you are to be killed by a gun.
Maybe we should start a new hashtag, White Lives Matter. White men lives matter. In other words, white men in this demographic are being slaughtered by drug companies selling them heroin, and they kill themselves. And
well, it's a very profitable thing, because you've said before if Auschwitz had been taken public, people would have invested in it. And here, in fact, they talk about the fact that they are pushing this on middle-aged white people, middle-aged white women. There's a huge increase in opiate overdose in places like Connecticut and Massachusetts, very rich New England states, and this is why something is actually starting to be done about it, not instead of gunning them down. There's actually something done on a legal level, on a legislative level, in order to address this, because before it was not these people in Connecticut and Massachusetts. So what they say is the average price of 100 micrograms of Subsys, the smallest dose available, is 70% higher this year than the average price in 2014. And the stock market has richly rewarded the Insys business plan. The company started marketing the drug in 2012, went public in May 2013, and went on to become that year's top-performing initial public offering. At press time, Insys shares were up over 600% since it began trading on the NASDAQ. So they went public they started marketing the drug in 2012. You could see the spike in deaths in the United States due to overdose of this very drug that they're using. So let's talk about the economics of this. Let's talk about the financial story behind this, because there are now action being taken on the state level, California, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Arizona, and Illinois, because their populations, the middle class populations, are being actually having a huge problem with this. Not only are they addicted, they become addicted to the likes of this fentanyl. And what happens is their doctors cut them off, and because their doctors cut them off, these tabs on the street, well, even to the doctor, cost a huge amount. So what they do is they end up going to heroin. They start scoring heroin on the street. So this is what the new big market. Dealers are no longer going to New York City. They're going out to Massachusetts and Connecticut and Vermont, out into the rural areas, and starting to sell their drugs out there. So they're calling it diversion as a form of medical fraud that can include doctors prescribing drugs for unintended use. So they're charging them with this diversion that they're basically that this company and the doctors they're alleging were colluding to basically give this as a prescription for all sorts of to remedy all sorts of things.
It's so disheartening to have to actually talk about this, because, you know, I'm thinking about the neighborhood where I grew up, in the towns where I grew up, and to think that these global trade deals and these pharmaceutical companies are committing medical genocide is disturbing.
Well, this is with those global trade deals. These companies have the right to go into whatever area they want in the world, and you can't do anything to stop it. So this is the death of your consumer, basically. This is how they're getting rid of the consumer.
Oops. Okay. Well, we got to go. Thank you.
See you, Max.
All right. Well, stay tuned for the second half.
Well, thanks, Max, for that update on how white men, 30 to 50, are killing themselves. A lot over the economics and the job market and everything else, but they're taking this stuff. And where are they getting a lot of this stuff? And they're getting heroin? Afghanistan, where your sons and daughters are over there fighting to save the poppy fields. Isn't that beautiful? But you hear any Republicans talking about that? Hardly ever hear even a Democrat talking about that. It's total crime organizations. Washington is the prime headquarters of Crime International. It should be shut down. It should be shut down. And if you didn't feel bad enough already, I'll leave today the show with another pessimist guide to history story. You thought you'd get away with it. You thought I forgot you, didn't you? Yeah. AD 1520, sad night of the Tenochtitlan, when Cortez arrived at a spectacular Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan in what is modern Mexico. In November 1519, he was greeted by the Aztec ruler Montezuma, who for a time believed Cortez to be a serpent god arriving to reclaim his throne. The Aztecs soon discovered the Spaniards' true purposes were conquest and confiscation of gold, jewels in the opulent city. Typical 16th century capitalism, predatory capitalism, took place in 1520. The Aztecs finally rose up against the 600 to 700 Spaniards after Cortez's men slaughtered hundreds of unarmed Aztec noblemen in the streets of Tenochtitlan. After days of bloody clashes, the Aztecs had the Spanish bottled up in a palace stronghold. On the morning of June 30th, the Aztecs attacked again, bringing the Spanish force near defeat. What followed was the Noche Triste, or Sad Night Massacre, during which the desperate Spanish fought their way out of Tenochtitlan at a cost of hundreds of Spanish lives. Escape from the city was no easy matter. Not only were the Spanish surrounded by hordes of enraged Aztecs, the city of Tenochtitlan was itself an island in a large lake. A causeway led from the city to the lakeshore, but the Aztecs had destroyed the bridges. That night, the Spaniards carried a hoard of gold and jewels, succeeded in slipping past the Aztecs, and then fought their way to the causeway. You know, those capitalists, predatory capitalists, can't leave without the goodies. They crossed the first gap using a portable bridge they had constructed while plotting their escape. But once across, they discovered their bridge was stuck in place. When they came to the next gap in the causeway with no bridge to help them across, the mass slaughter began. The soldiers were weighted down by their heavy armor and by the treasure of gold and jewels they refused to leave behind, and so became easy targets for the Aztecs. Aztec warriors moved swiftly through the darkness in lightweight canoes, attacking the Spanish on the causeway from all sides. As hundreds of Spanish soldiers were killed, many of them fell forward off the edge of the causeway into Lake Texcoco and quickly sank to the bottom. Soon the pile of bodies, treasure, horses, armor, and wagons grew so numerous that the surviving soldiers raced across the pile to the next section of the causeway. Once they reached the next gap, the massacre began again, continuing until bodies and equipment again piled high enough to bridge the gap. Cortez lost about half his men in the fighting, but eventually succeeded in escaping from the Aztec Empire. But not for long. Later, Cortez came back with a vengeance. Yeah, there you go. Now, in 1520, human sacrifice among the Aztec civilization that the Spanish discovered in South America, was surprisingly advanced, except for one particularly nasty religious ritual that called for human sacrifice. The practice of doubt shocked the Spanish. But then again, this was during the Inquisition, so they wouldn't have been too shocked. The Spanish made the Aztecs stop the practice, which was one good point in their favor during their otherwise cruel conquest of the New World. While the actual number who died over the centuries as part of this grisly ritual is not known, the Aztecs usually chose victims for sacrifice among enemy soldiers taken as captives during the war. But the ritual killing was a sacred rite, not considered punishment or humiliation. The Aztecs believed their victims traveled to the gods, bearing the messages from the Aztec nation. Like the Christian nuts. That was little comfort to the victims, however, as they were pinned down against a sacrificial stone by their hands, feet, and heads. A priest then sliced open the victim's chest, pulled out his heart, and raised it up in an offering to the gods. Arms and legs were then served at banquets, and wild animals got the rest. Fresh kill is always tastiest. You see, the religions are all lunatics, crazy. Various occasions apparently called for human sacrifice, including special festival days, celestial events, and the dedications of the temples. According to chronicles, when Aztec king Ahuitzotl dedicated a new temple at the capital of Tenochtitlan, he blessed the event by offering the sacrifice of an incredibly 80,000 people to the gods. The gods must have been overjoyed. Yeah, that's it for the day. That's it for the week. 14-5. And I don't sympathize with the Spaniards at all. They were driven by the same old type mercantilism of gold and silver and greed and all of everything that went along with it. People like that deserve to die.
Happy tales to you until we meet again. Happy tales to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Happy trails to you. cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Happy trails to you.